Broadcasting from the confines of an abandoned radio station in the secluded ghost town of High Strangeness. That's just outside of Area 51. It's time for full disclosure of the topics they told us were off limits. Good evening. Good morning. Hello, everybody. Hi, I'm Connie Willis, and this is Coast to Coast AM. From the 840 WHAS studios of iHeartMedia in Louisville, Kentucky, home of Bib Lettuce, the Triple Crown winner, American Pharoah, who won the Derby and then came back here and did the Breeders' Cup as well. Congratulations. Ooh, that's ooh. And also, believe it or not, the cheeseburger. Yep, home of the cheeseburger. Kalen Restaurant right here in Louisville invented the cheeseburger back in 1934. Then it was like a year later, somebody else went ahead and patented it out of Denver. So, you know, go figure. A southern way of eating a burger. Throw some cheese on it. Well, again, Connie Willis here on Coast to Coast AM. Tonight, 40 years ago this month, Travis Walton, wonderful guy. His life changed forever. We all know his story, Fire in the Sky. We're going to ask him how he's doing now, 40 years later. And a famous photo enthusiast also talks to the dead via apps, portals, and they talk back to him. Steve Huff, he's going to be joining us, and we're going to get to hear some of those conversations. They're not going to be all muffled up. You're going to freak out. I'm telling you, it's crazy stuff. So we're going to be getting started right after this here, so I want you all to please turn off the lights and join me for another interesting evening of conversation, much-needed education, and the chance that we might get a little closer to the truth of what lurks amongst us and what is beyond. Connie Willis here tonight, and this is Coast to Coast AM. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. Hi, everybody. I'm Connie Willis, and we're going to get right to this guest because we have 1 hour with the infamous Travis Walton, and I wish we had a whole lot more time. Travis, how are you?
Okay. You said infamous.
Infamous? Okay.
To the skeptics, I'm infamous.
Well, you know what? How do you like to be described by everybody?
I'm just ordinary guy with an extraordinary experience.
Well, there you go. That's absolutely perfect. You know what? I mean, Travis, I mean, people know you from Fire in the Sky. I mean, you are one of the, you're huge. Your story's huge. But if they've ever met you in person, you are just, you're right, normal, typical guy, wonderful person, wonderful friend. I'm glad to know you. If you were just shopping in Kroger or something, nobody would know, hey, who's that? You know, you're just a very typical normal guy, and I appreciate that. And here you were 40 years ago just minding your own business, having, you know, little arguments with somebody here or there, like, you know, one of your crew, and doing your work and logging away, and then you're heading home, and bam, your life was changed. And I think, as you explained it too, you're a little cocky there heading to this light, trying to be a little tough, and you'll never do that again.
Nope, I learned from that mistake.
So I think you're at a conference now, but you just had your 40th annual, or not, well, 40th anniversary, basically. Yeah. I think you've just done it a couple times, the Skyfire Summit UFO Conference, correct?
Yeah. And for the first time, we had the sheriff's deputy, who was the first to meet with the crew when they returned from the woods. It took the sheriff, more than an hour longer to get there. So it was really cool to get his reaction, his impression of the men while their experience was freshest.
Yeah,
and this was the first time Deputy Ellison had done any interview of any kind.
Back then, what were his thoughts, and what are his thoughts now, 40 years later?
Well, I think, after being around the crewmen and, becoming more familiar with the story, he actually became more believing after he got there. But he was very objective, professional, that he was just, stating that he didn't see anything that cast any doubt on it, and plenty that impressed him with that something terrible had just happened. And he it was his remark that said, if those guys are actors, they're the best actors that have ever lived.
I couldn't imagine what you guys went through. I'm a believer of you. I totally, you know, I think you're straight up. I don't have any problems with the story, but I know there's a ton of skeptics out there, and I know it's a fantastic story for people. But, you know, I don't know who would ever stop and think about this and figure this out and try to connive a story like this with as many guys that were involved in it and then have to live with it the rest of their life and continue to stick with that story. I mean, that would just be, you know, absurd to do.
It's not like we were a tight-knit bunch of guys, you know. We were just coworkers. And, you know, the skeptics have come up with all kinds of stupid things. And, you know, people who don't want to believe, they'll latch on to anything. You know, it can be really lame and not really fit the facts of the case at all. And people, you know, cling desperately to it. Like one theory to explain it away that's, you know, sort of persisted all these years is that it was a drug hallucination.
Oh.
And what anybody that, you know, thought about it for 2 minutes would realize is that seven people are not going to have an identical hallucination. You know, aside from the fact that I had blood and urine samples put through the county medical examiner's drug screen, which proved there was no trace of any drug in my body.
Anytime there's any paranormal thing like this, nobody ever believes it. And that's why we only get so many of the stories, you know. There, who knows how many other events are happening similar to yours, but we'll never hear because of the fact that nobody's going to believe you, and they have to deal with that over and over again. In fact, somebody wanted to make sure, you know, when they knew that the show was going to happen and you're going to be on it, they wanted to make sure that I had thanked you for telling your story so that other people that go through this that cannot tell anybody, that you're at least open with it so that people know that there is something, there is a story out there, and they believe that you are helping them.
Yeah, you know, well, there's a price to me in my life to be talking about this, but you know, there's a purpose for being out here, and that is to make people realize, the mainstream people realize that there's a core reality here. You know, not every report is in the same line as what we experienced, but there's a core reality here that people need to be aware of. It's very important. It's going to be a major step forward in humanity when society in general is ready to accept this. That's when open acknowledgement, I believe, will finally occur.
I agree with you. And I want to read what this man said because it was wonderful, okay, if you don't mind. It says, if you get a chance, remind Travis that for those of us whom struggle with abduction, PTSD, and dealing with family members, people at work, etc., who don't believe us, that Travis sharing his experiences is a comfort to the rest of us, that we are not alone in recognizing that the world is not how we grew up being taught by our teachers, priests, and other authority figures. His taking his time of sharing his experiences is a mental health service for the rest of us, especially those new people whom have only recently had close encounter experiences and need to hear from others that they are not alone. And I just thought that was so special.
Very well stated.
Yes, I agree. Right on it. And you are wonderful. I mean, you know, I've known your story, of course, for a long, long time. We've hung out. But, you know, I've watched some of the documentaries that you've done recently, and by the one with Jennifer Stein. Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. She did a great job with that documentary. And I know you've done many others for people, but watching them all again, you know, Travis, I mean, you've become so educated in so many areas that you would have never thought you would have been educated in, I'm sure. So what do you think you would have done if that would not have happened?
Oh,
where would you be?
You know, I had, you know, the world was open to me. I could be anything, but once this happened, for certain, I became aware that a great deal of certain opportunities and avenues in life were forever closed to me. You know, for my conference, I had a T-shirt made that I'm offering here. And it says, for those who refuse to believe, no amount of evidence is ever enough. For those who have experienced it, no more proof is necessary.
Oh, love it. Love it. That's a bumper sticker and a T-shirt and a hat. That's a big old shirt. That's, I like that. I like that. Well, after 40 years, has there been anything new that has come from this or any changes?
Oh, yeah. It's amazing that after all this time, there are new things, you know. There is new evidence at the site concerning the tree ring research.
All right.
It was like 15 years before it was discovered that the trees nearest where the craft had come down had grown at many times the previous rate. But only this last summer, we had a research expedition to the site and gridded it off and went back with the Geiger counters and magnetic readings and everything to reassess things. And only then was it discovered that this tree ring increase, this thickness in the growth rings, was on the side of the tree towards the craft. Whether it was east, west, north, or south of where the craft came down, the thickened rings were primarily on the side towards the craft. Now, Ben Hansen, who supervised this this research expedition, found some research concerning the pine trees in the vicinity of the Chernobyl nuclear accident. And those trees had accelerated growth at three times the normal rate. But since the radiation was completely surrounding the tree, it was uniform. But in the case of these trees here, it's on the side of the tree towards where the craft came down, which is...
Oh, that's interesting.
Very, what Ben referred to as significant findings.
Absolutely. Very telling. Absolutely. Wow. That's some scary stuff, too, just on the side
because,
of it.
The crewmen that I left behind in the truck were pretty much protected by the truck, but when I got out, I left the door open, and Ken Peterson was the crewman next to me, and he has now developed skin cancer on his right arm, which was exposed there. So I'm wondering if there isn't some connection there.
That's interesting. Well, what about you? Have you noticed
anything?
Well, you
see, I was subjected to a massive amount of energy that I think was actually repaired by the aliens.
That's right.
That really, if had I not been injured in that way, they might not have never taken me aboard.
That's
right. People who find fault with the crew for having taken off and left me there, you know, in a way, I'm actually fortunate that they didn't come back and haul my body away, because I think I would have been dead beyond any hope. Nair's hospital was over an hour away.
Well, you know, I believe, and I think you have the same belief, that it was just a one-time kind of thing. You just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, or the right place at the right time, whichever way you want to look at it. It doesn't seem like to me, I mean, you tell me that you're someone that's, this has happened all your life and you've been picked up many, many times. Seems like this is kind of a one-time abduction. Do you agree?
Yeah.
Still?
I hope so.
Okay. Yeah. I don't want to go hanging out with Travis in the woods. You never know what might happen. But that being the case, I think, you know, at one point for the longest time, it was what happened, you know, why me? But I think with you being aboard, I think I love your last conclusion of why you believe they did take you aboard. And I'll let you tell that story.
Well, you know, it took me a long time with a whole lot of circumstances pointing in the same direction that the reason they were taking me aboard was not any kind of a planned, quote, abduction, but actually just sort of an emergency response to me getting out of that truck and going up there and doing something unexpected and getting myself hurt, probably mortally wounded.
I just think that is a wonderful conclusion. I got to tell you, it makes me feel, with my intuition, that I think you're right. I think they took you aboard and healed you.
Yeah. Well, in the aftermath of it, I was really worried that I would come down with some horrible, you know, thing, at least, you know, cancer from radiation exposure or something. Because, you know, they did have the high Geiger counter readings at the site. But when that didn't manifest itself and my health continued to be good, as a matter of fact, more better and better as time went on,
wow.
You know, it was only after I could go into my employers and get the record and the proof that I was willing to talk about the fact that I never called in sick in these 40 years, you know.
Wow. Well, and then you talk about the trees, how they were affected, and then you talk about your buddy with his arm that was, was hit by the radiation because of the window being open. I mean, wow, it kind of matches up again. I think you're right on that. I really do. They actually, it was a rescue mission.
Yeah. When I came to the first time, I think repairs it were just rudimentary at that point, that it was just basic revival. But I felt mortally wounded. I felt like something was deadly wrong inside. But me fighting them off was actually preventing them from, taking care of me.
But who wouldn't?
I think they needed these human-looking species to come in there and reassure me and get me under control.
Yeah.
Because I think because of the blast of energy to my head, that it disrupted the neurological circuits in a way that prevented their normal control, which I believe was exerted through the stare. I had a medical doctor come up to me in a recent conference and say, you have to understand that the eyes are actually an extension of the brain. It's the one opening through the skull through a soft tissue that if there's an energy being transmitted, that it, could actually go through the eyes, through the front of the skull that way. And when the three of them were staring at me like that, it felt very, very uncomfortable in a very strange kind of way. And so one of the medical tests I had in the aftermath was an EEG. And this is at a world-famous brain trauma center, Barrows Neurological Institute. And the technician was not informed of who I was or what was the nature of the injury he was looking for when he discovered this anomalous pattern. And so that's one of the new things that's on the horizon, is to do follow-up research on this anomalous brainwave pattern. One is to have a modern neuroscientist analyze that in comparison to someone who might have been hit by lightning or electrocuted or something. And then also to repeat the EEG and see if that pattern is still there.
Mm. Wow, I'm just so happy that things are still, we're still learning things from this. When you were just talking about, the guys, the little creatures looking at you, the three of them, and you feeling that stare, and that's when you fought them off, and that's very understandable. In that position, I would hope that I had the courage to do that too. And then when you went off on your own, and then you said another being came in, and they looked human, but they had like a helmet on. I just out of curiosity, is it possible that I think you're right? Somebody came that looks human to make you feel more comfortable. That's probably a good thing to think. But do you think it could have been one of those little guys, and they put some helmet on that looked like a human head? Because you said it didn't talk to you or anything.
A huge difference in size. So I wrestled with him at one point, and It felt very solid, so I don't think it was any kind of an illusion.
Okay.
I do believe that there are a lot of similarities between life forms on other planets and here. Mm. I even think that a lot of what's described as quote-unquote grays are a number of species that just happen to be small, hairless, large-eyed creatures.
I think I've seen a few of those on Match.com myself. I think they've winked at me. but that is amazing that, they looked very human, and they had to have a helmet on their head to breathe, and you didn't.
Yeah, I don't think it was just to prevent an exchange of microbes. I think that perhaps the atmosphere in there wasn't quite correct for humans.
Mm. Wow. You have remembered so much from your experience that is just, if anybody can fathom the fear and the terror, that they would be more kind with some of that skepticism and you know, just learn from you. So I appreciate that you have been so open about it for the past 40 years. And we're going to learn a little bit more from you. We're going to do this again with you sometime with myself. I'm looking forward to that because we could talk all night with yourself. So more questions to come with Travis Walton here. Just recapping 40 years ago, Fire in the Sky, what he wrote about is what happened to him, and just a courageous man to tell us what he's telling us. We really appreciate that. So, Travis Walton, still more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. It's Coast to Coast AM. I'm Connie Willis, and we are talking to Travis Walton. And a little later on, we're going to be talking to Steve Huff, who talks to the dead, and we're going to hear how they talk back to him. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm Connie Willis, and we are discussing great information from Travis Walton. 40 years ago this month, he was taken up into a spacecraft of some sort, and he came back down. According to the movie in Hollywood, he came back down naked. Travis, what's the deal? How many things did they make up in the Fire in the Sky movie that was not true? And how much did they just totally, I mean, what was the good stuff they should have added?
Well, the naked thing is a typical Hollywood embellishment, but
yes.
Actually, it is kind of a metaphor for the intrusion into my life that instantly I was under a microscope in front of the world. But there was one thing that was in the film that didn't happen, you know, because most of the changes were what happened aboard the craft. You know, it was actually very sterile and very mechanical inside, and they made it look very cluttered and organic, which is not the case. But the scene where the actor awakens on the table, three beings are standing around him, and there's this membrane over his face, and he's struggling to scream, struggling to breathe through it. And there was no membrane, but it is a better way of communicating to the audience the feeling of suffocation I was experiencing. Because otherwise you really wouldn't understand why I just went so out of my mind with fear. You know, the feeling of suffocation generates a panic that you just can't reason away. You know, the waterboarding that they use on terrorists, you know, is something that they're aware of. They plan for it. They train for it. They know that it's not going to kill them, but it works anyway. And it's because of that feeling of suffocation. Just there's no greater panic.
Well, I tell you, that visual did. It made it hard to watch and hard to breathe as you were watching it. So we definitely felt what you would have been feeling. So it's great to hear that you say that is a great representation of what you went through. However, that's not what occurred. When you say that the area inside the ship was sterile and like smooth, sanitary, what about your other senses? Did you notice a smell or any? Did you touch anything? And
you know, I'm frequently asked about a smell because that's so, you know, intricately connected to memory. But I don't really remember any particular smell, and so either there wasn't any or the injury of being blasted by that bolt of energy through, you know, my head may have impaired my sense of smell temporarily.
What about textures when you were feeling the chair, I guess, or maybe the walls? Anything different?
Well, it was a sort of a matte texture. It felt very smooth, but non-reflective. You know, it's possible that there could have been writing. I didn't see any writing, but if there was writing that would be visible in a frequency that human eye doesn't detect, you know, there could have been print all over the place that I just couldn't see.
Travis, what was that like that when you woke up realizing, you know, you're like running away from these three beings, and then you're kind of going through this ship, and you know, you see what you think is a wall, and then you see this chair, and then you see like the stars kind of change. I mean, what comes to my mind is Star Trek and being in the Enterprise or being in some, you know, alien ship. I mean, obviously you were. I mean, you had to come to that image in your own head and realization. I mean, what was that like? I mean, you were really there.
Well, you know, it's like it was, I don't know whether it was a planetarium, like, you know, just a map projected there, or if it was some method they have of viewing their surroundings. But I just can't imagine that being the basis of navigation, you know, visual contact with these stars. That might just be something that was incidental or coincidental to, you know, close proximity navigation. This is occurring to me as I'm speaking, you know, because it just doesn't seem like, you know, the navigation would be based on that. But who knows what kind of technology is involved there.
But when you're running from one room to the other, I mean, you got to be going, oh, my gosh, I'm in a ship. What, you know, what is going through your head?
Well, you know, the additional panic that came not just from the feeling of suffocation, from seeing something so strange, from the feeling that I was mortally wounded, the claustrophobic effect of being in such cramped quarters, dimly lit like that. There was also the feeling that I couldn't move as quickly and as energetically as I wanted. You know, something was terribly wrong inside, but I felt weaker than I should be. You know, I can't move as quick, and the feeling that I'm trying to flee and not really able to generate the kind of force that I wanted.
Wow. Have you ever had sleep paralysis before?
No.
No.
But, I've heard about it, and I don't know if that's similar. I don't know whether it was because I was injured, because I was hypoxic, or maybe the gravity was heavier in there. I don't know.
Yeah, some sort of atmospheric conditions there.
Maybe more than one of those.
Right, or something even different. How do you know there at that point? But, okay, all right, let's go off the ship a little bit here. You had a lot of lie detector testing, and I guess somebody failed. One was inconclusive. Did you fail any of them? How many did you guys take, and how significant do you believe the polygraph test is in this circumstance?
Well, you know, people criticize polygraph because they're not 100%. But at the time that there were six passed tests, the president of the American Polygraph Association said that the odds of there being a mistake when you've got six people passing tests on the same issue were over 1,000,000 to 1. And that was then with six tests, but now there's been 16 passed tests. I've passed 5 tests from 3 examiners with top-notch credentials, years of law enforcement. The Department of Public Safety polygraph examiner, Cy Gilson, that tested the men and actually everyone involved, was actually a police officer for a number of years before becoming the lie detector expert. And he was an interrogation specialist even before learning polygraph. So, you know, you couldn't have better credentials than that. There was an attempt at a polygraph immediately after that was touted as the ultimate answer, but it wasn't because, you know, it's been criticized by people like Cy Gilson as being totally incompetent, violating all of the modern science of polygraph because, you know, this was a guy who got his training like 40 years before and was just doing all kinds of things, using a method that had been abandoned by modern polygraph for quite a number of years. But much better than the last two that I took, which were, you know, graded by computer and the examiner simultaneously. It was a modern 5-trace machine by an examiner that was doing work for the New Mexico State Prisons, the Albuquerque Police Department, and even the U.S. Marshals Service.
When was these last ones done?
This was fairly recent, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, I guess.
How do you feel that, do you think that these are a good thing for people to use when they've come across stories like this? I mean, these things do put people in prison, don't they?
Yeah, well, you know, it's ironic that if you had six people without lie detector tests say that they had witnessed the murder, most people would just consider that an open and shut case. But suddenly, when it involves a UFO, six witnesses' testimony is not enough, even with polygraph tests on top of that.
What's the one thing that you think that got you through this ordeal to bring you where you are today? What is it that kept you hanging in there and not just throwing your hands up and saying, just leave me alone, I wish this never happened to me, I don't care what you think, get out of my life?
Well, you know, I was tempted by that, but, you know, I had the strength of six witnesses who saw what I saw, and, you know, of course they're going to stand by what we experience no matter what. And, you know, under considerable pressure, the youngest guy on the crew was offered a $10,000 bribe to discredit the incident by the foremost debunker of the case.
He offered money. Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And, certainly not the kind of money that debunker made at his job. And there's no doubt that this is documented by the fact that a deputy sheriff carried the message.
Well, didn't somebody owe you $1,000? Didn't somebody do another thing with $1,000?
Well, it was the same guy that wagered $1,000 that he had six unassailable points, and I, you know, picked each one of them apart. But one of them was that I had said that I had been bleeding heavily when I was returned.
No.
And he made a big deal. There was no blood on his clothing. This is just false. Well, you go back and you listen to the tape, and it's quite clear that I said I was breathing.
Breathing. Heavily. Right.
And so he never paid off on that. However, you know, he had some wagers with a UFO lecturer and a nuclear physicist, Stan Friedman, where he did have to pay off on the wager that he had lost.
Stan went after him to get the money. You got to get Stan to go get the money, give him 10%.
Yeah.
That's how you work
but,
that one
you know,
out.
After the debunker died, the Freedom of Information Act revealed that he had been under investigation by the FBI and that they had basically withheld prosecution and turned his case over to the Central Intelligence Agency.
Oh.
You know, there's a memo from J. Edgar Hoover to the director of the CIA, you know, who had a reputation back before 9/11 as not communicating with each other enough, you know.
Wow.
And here they were turning the case over to the CIA, and I think ultimately, probably the source of that $10,000 that was being offered to Steve to say it was all a hoax or something.
Wow, it all comes out in the end, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Truth always comes out. Here's a question. I don't know if you have ever thought about this or not, but 40 years ago when this happened and you guys came across this, all right, and it just so happened that, you know, you went out, looked at it, boom, got up there, and they were taking care of you because of that. And I'm with you on that one. Just because you were there as it happened and then even inside to kind of look around a little bit, why do you think they were there in the first place? Any gut feeling of why they might have been there?
You know? I really clung to the idea for a long time that it was just an accident, because that would imply that, you know, it was kind of a bolt from the blue and not likely to happen again. Now, Steve and Alan think that they were waiting for us in particular, but I can't imagine why, you know. How could they even know we would come out by that road? There's lots of roads out of there. It could be we just happened upon them and I did something unexpected.
No, but why do you think the actual ship was there in the first place?
Well, it could have been an agricultural experiment. I've had a number of researchers looking into the possibility of every possibility about what would be particular about that area. Underground mineral deposits, geothermal, you know, magnetic anomalies, and haven't found anything that would really set that spot apart, except, you know, this rapid tree growth, which could have just been a coincidental or incidental to the presence of a radiation source.
Yeah, you know, when you in Arizona, you usually think of no trees, but that area is very much forest.
The largest ponderosa pine forest in the world.
It seems like maybe, I mean, that could even be a place to, I guess, I don't know, but if you're roaming around and then you want to hide, maybe you can, you know, hide in the trees for a little bit. Maybe it's a little getaway.
Yeah, at that time, the forest was quite dense. Now, the forest fire has really opened things up there. We would only catch glimpses of San Francisco Peaks, which is a giant mountain by Flagstaff that was actually an extinct volcano. That's 5,000 feet higher than where we are there at the site, which is actually the highest point in that area. It's 7,000 feet, but, you know, the 12,000 feet to the peaks over there, you can actually see them like 80 miles away. It's nothing in between us.
Wow. Well, we're talking with Travis Walton here. It was 40 years ago this month that the event happened to him, where he was taken aboard a ship, and you all know the story as Fire in the Sky. So, Travis, before we take off here, and I really want to talk to you again in a much longer a time period, is there anything you want to say to anyone or anything about this after 40 years later?
Well, I don't know. There's all kinds of things on the horizon, you know. All this upcoming research, and, you know, my 40th anniversary conference, we'll try to repeat that next year on the anniversary, and all this upcoming research, and looking at the possibility of a remake of the movie. I've been collecting emails from people who had expressed interest in seeing a remake that would stick closer to what actually happened. And also, you know, with my current understanding of what happened. So
that will be fantastic.
That might happen.
Yeah, I would really like to see that because, you know, we always want to, you know, people like us, we want to see the real thing. We don't need it Hollywoodized. It's already fantastic as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, again, Jen Stein's Travis, that was wonderful. I really enjoyed that because you really got into the other crew as well and talked with them. And, you did tell how you feel about what happened now, you know, looking back at it. So I just want to thank you so much, Travis. Thanks for taking time out of the conference you're in right now and saying hello to us and just catching us back up to date after 40 years.
Great interview, Connie.
It's always good to talk with you. So more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. In fact, we're going to have conversations from the other side. Steve Huff is next here on Coast to Coast AM.